This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest for this week and for the next 2 weeks is Kim McLean. Kim McLean is a singer and songwriter originally from Greensboro, North Carolina. She moved to Nashville in the late 1980s with the dream she shared with many others of becoming a performer. And while she did have some success as a performer, she was much more successful as a writer. After working for more than a decade in Nashville, she had amassed enough money to go back to school. She dropped out of school in her late teens because of a serious eating disorder. In the early 2000s, she completed her undergraduate education and went on to earn a PhD in leadership and professional practice, focusing on the music business. For the past 2 years, she has been the director of the songwriting program at Tribeca Nazarene University in Nashville. She also runs Hippie Chick Twang. According to their website, Hippie Chick Twang is a sound. Hippie Chick Twang is a record label. Hippie Chick Twang is a music publishing company. Hippie Chick Twang is an event. Hippie Chick Twang is a creative community. Hippie Chick Twang is a lifestyle. A combustion that happens when like minds gather to paint the world into a more beautiful picture. In her spare time, she's working on writing and recording a new album. This is a song from her last album, released in 2012, called Shadows and Light. This is the lead song from the album, Tightrope. When we talked by phone a couple of months back now, Kim McLean was at home in Nashville on the porch. It was a beautiful afternoon. We started out talking, and not surprisingly perhaps, about the slightly mystical process of songwriting.
When I sit down to write a song, it's like I go into this eternal time frame. And I come out, it might be 2 to 3 hours later, but it's with this greater sense of satisfaction and joy. And it's an interesting thing. You know, they call it flow. The lingo these days in the creative circles, scientific creative circles, is calling it flow. We get into a flow state, and that's part of what characterizes a flow state, is being oblivious to time and not feeling it pass, and kind of oblivious to yourself. Because for me, it feels like something you might see portrayed in animation in a Disney movie or something, where you go through a science fiction movie, where you pass through some sort of tunnel and you go to another dimension, and you come back with something beautiful from another world, from another dimension of this world. And there is no time, because time is a construct anyway, you know.
If that wasn't ever evident before, it certainly is now, you know. I think that's maybe one of the most profound effects of the pandemic, is to make us all realize how badly we've, at least I speak for myself perhaps, how badly we use time. Mm-hmm. And misuse it, but also that our perception of time is—it really is just something we've created. It doesn't really mean anything,
right? I feel that sometimes I have felt a little guilty, because being quarantined has helped me so much. Because I don't have to go drive to meetings. I don't have to spend an hour getting ready to leave. And it's given me this gift of time, and I'm getting some things done that I've wanted to get done for so long. And doing some writing that is just for the joy of the writing, and, you know, that I've wanted to do for so long. And one of the promises that I'm making to myself is that as I establish a new lifestyle during this quarantine, that I would begin to imagine this lifestyle into my future, even though I'll have to be more balanced, you know, and I'll have to be in the alleged real world. But there's a way to carry this spirit, this attitude, this aspect on the meaning of life and time that I think I can carry into the rest of my life instead of giving so much of my time away, you know, with some of the status quo and the mundane, you know?
I do. I don't know how you feel about this, but I've spent quite a lot of time listening to your music, and I have the impression that the Shadows and Light record is a record that is kind of a pivotal point for you, where one half of the records, just the sound of the first half of the record, definitely underscores the name. It does sound shadowy. It does sound slightly darker than the second half, Light, which is, for the most part, you know, much more upbeat, and the arrangements are much more open-handed, if you will. They're as funky, and they have the same momentum and same delightful melody as the first half, but there's definitely a mood switch. And I was wondering if that's true, if at that point in your life that was a moment of taking stock, and that's why you made that record.
Yes. I used some of the new songs that I wrote for the Shadows side of this project. I used some minor modalities and keys, a little more. I was really playing a lot. There's a chord, five minor chords, that I was really playing with a lot on this project. I think about it a lot. And I had not noticed I'd done it until I got into the studio. But, you know, a song, a commercial song, they're all based around a 1, 4, 5, 6 minor, basically, is in almost every contemporary song that you ever hear in any genre, really. So I was playing around a lot with a 5 minor and a five chord in music theory, which is a major. And I thought about that because when I was recording this project, one of my players in the studio said, "Boy, you sure do like that 5 minor chord. You've got it in so many of these songs." I had not even noticed I did it. But that's a shadowy, it's not a dark chord in context. Minor chords are darker than major chords, but it's shadowy. You know, the shadows accent the light. I think, you know, when you look at great art, or Rembrandt and Rembrandt's shadows and Van Gogh's light, all of that swirling around together, and that makes you notice the shadows make you notice the depth of the light. You know, they keep it from washing out. So that is what I was trying to do sonically, and I was taking stock of my life and my musical journey. This was a pivotal project because, you know, of course, as the artist and the creator of it, I always see all of my imperfections because that's kind of how I am. I always think, oh, I can do this better, I can do this better. But I was really working through some of the struggles in telling the story of some of the struggles in my life, and, you know, even with the opening song, Tightrope. I know these days it doesn't matter the sequence of your songs, but since this is in a CD format, I was thinking complete project and complete statement, you know. And I wrote that song with a really sad, it's a long song, so I wrote it so much slower than it turned out, because that's the way I was feeling it. Like, I'm walking on a tightrope. I've always walked on this tightrope in my life, and it's like, if you lose your balance, you're going to fall and you're going to lose everything. How a music career can feel sometimes if you don't acquiesce to the requirements that it takes within the industry to have commercial success. Then you don't get to make a living, then you don't get to keep making the music that you make. And it always felt like a tightrope, walking a tightrope for me, you know, feeling that I had something to say as an artist, but being a writer for all of the other artists, and striking that balance between my art and the commerce, and being grateful for being able to make a living doing what I love, but being in a commercial context, it's the music business. It's not the same as fine art, you know. And so, yes, I'm answering your question in a very long way. But it's the shadows side was a grappling. Some of those songs were written years before I made this project. I had been saving some songs and thinking, I'm going to record this song. And then I wrote new songs for the project, and I was just looking at my career and my life in an integrated way. It's not, okay, I've got my personal life and I've got my career. This was an integration of that, and realizing that it's always really been integrated, but it's just a matter of the lens through which I see it, and allowing it to come together and saying, okay, this is sort of happy, sad. And then the light side, I didn't use the whole band on the light side. You know, I had some that were guitar vocals on that side just to keep it very lighter in its musical load as well, lighter in the arrangement.
Seems like there's more strings on that violin and or fiddle, yeah. I guess, and a mandolin.
Yes, I did. And some amazing musicians working with me on that. And we just created the arrangements as we went in the studio. And I had rented out the studio long enough to be able to have that luxury to do that. And the light side deals with topics that represent so much of my spirituality, my spiritual practice, and my faith. So that has undergirded everything I've ever done, and all of it, even when I was in a dark place in my life. So the light side exemplifies that eternal optimism that is always with me, no matter what happens. that part where, you know, without the shadows, I don't have the light, but without the light carries me through the shadows, and so. Yeah, it's that dance between the two.
I've been talking to the sage son, hear him calling when the morning comes, and the thoughts I knew as the frost on the ground.
On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. Our guest is songwriter Kim MacLean. The album we've been talking about, Shadows on Light, is effectively a double album. This is from the Light album. It's called Save Your Son.
Of eternal life, the spirit burns like a candle's light in all of us when we praise the Savior's Son. His name is Jesus, Shepherd King of all the earth, holy birth for all who live. His name is Jesus, Spirit frees us, the King.
The more I read about you and listened to your songs, the more I started thinking, oh my God, how am I ever going to be able to talk to Kim about all the things that she's done and the remarkable life that you've had without keeping you sitting there for 3 days? But, and then I started listening to this record, and that gives us a kind of template to talk about the arc of your life, if you will.
Yeah.
I wanted to first mention that they quoted you as saying in, you were talking to students, I think, about songwriting, and said that producers in Nashville often refer to artists who don't know who they are or what they have to say as singing meat. And you went on to tell them, don't be singing meat if you're an artist. At least have some idea of who you are and what you want to say. And it seemed to me that listening to your music, that was always the case for you. You always knew who you were and what you wanted to say. It was more a question of how would you, as you were saying before, about the commercial music business, how do you find a place in it where you can do that? When you first came to Nashville in the mid-80s, I have the feeling that you weren't exactly greeted with open arms. A young woman in Nashville was still something of an outsider. Is that true?
And in some sense, yes. Yeah, some of the stigmas that and cliches regarding young women and young attractive women entertainment world are very true. And I encountered, I was welcomed with open arms in some ways. But I had such a bent, such a determination to be professional, I didn't realize those cliches and stereotypes, you know, that the stigma that can be on where the men, it really is, they've often called Nashville a boys club, and I encountered something of that. And so as a female trying to break in and you're trying to be as professional as the men, and you're having those conversations, and from my perspective, I was talking from the same determination of I want to support my family as they were, and I wanted to use my gifts. But often, I didn't even realize there were some instances where I was being talked down to, or where I was invited to the party, so to speak, because I was a young, attractive female with talent. You know, it's that old stigma of, you know, I'm not a blonde, but it's the you don't have to be someone who thinks. Have to look pretty. But I say that, you know, I it's never been my desire to emphasize that too much. It's a reality in worlds even beyond the entertainment industry. And it was only in retrospect that I realized I'd even been treated that way because I was so determined. So I think the deeper truth is that what you're determined to do and what you're on this earth to do, and you determine what your path is. And so I was living by a deeper truth than what my cultural milieu was. And I think that that's why I was able to make headway, make progress, because I was oblivious to a lot of those attitudes toward me as a, you know, the remarks that would be made about my body or whatever. I never found them offensive. There were a couple of times when I had to stand up for myself, but, you know, I thought, great, I'm glad you find me attractive. Now, could we write a great song? Could you tell me how to write a great song? Could you tell me how to get this song recorded? In fact, that's one of the reasons I admire, an extreme example would be Dolly Parton. To this day, you never hear her in an interview without referencing the Twin Peaks, you know. And, but she is the consummate professional and a great songwriter and a great businesswoman. And she just took those attitudes toward her. And not that I was ever attracted in that way, but there is the thing with the young girl, the young woman in this town. You've got to have a certain look. And you'd be behind the scenes and you'd hear them talking about, oh, so-and-so got a record deal and then got fat. And then she'd get dropped. And it didn't matter her talent. And I encountered all of that. But I did have something to say when I moved to town, and I did not move to town to be an artist. I moved to be here to be a songwriter. And so what happened for me, I was not embraced as an artist. I was, though, embraced very quickly as a songwriter.
That's interesting. Well, first of all, it sounds to me as if you're equating artist and performer. The artist is the person who is in the spotlight. Seems to me that you're as much an artist as somebody standing with a guitar and singing the song, whether they even if they wrote it, which I think in many cases they didn't. But what's really interesting to me is that you're a relatively young woman coming into, as you say, what was largely considered a boys' game. And I guess it says a lot that I can probably count on one hand the number of women who are writing from a woman's perspective, maybe Kitty Wells, Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton. Mm-hmm. There's not too many others, right?
Loretta Lynn.
Yeah, she's often credited as having broken that taboo, right? That mm-hmm. you could write from a woman's perspective. Were you expected to write songs as if you were writing from a male perspective or a kind of neutral perspective, or could you write from your own point of view?
Well, several things come to mind in what you just said, because you've raised a couple of different points. First of all, on the point of artist and performer being equivalent, and a songwriter is not an artist, and I'd like to just makes me want to just come over and give you a big old hug for you to tell me that you see the artistic value in what I do, because I didn't know that artists and performers are equated until I moved to Nashville. That's a very Nashville thought. That's a very music industry thought. There are songwriters and there are artists. And the songwriter writes for the artist. And artist is, yes, that lingo is equivalent with the performer, the one with the record deal, the one who's up front, the one who is the profile. The songwriter gives them something to say. And it's interesting because I write with Loretta Lynn now, and we're dear friends. And, well, I haven't been able to write with her in person since the COVID started, but so now we're talking on the phone. But I've been able to go back and hear her story, and she was the artist and the writer, and really was not trying. She wasn't trying to. She was doing exactly what I did. She was writing her truth. She just didn't know any better, you know. But she did have the record deal by the time I came along, because she's, you know, she's my parents' age. So by the time I came along, there was already this difference where there are songwriters who get publishing deals, and if you were somebody who could be a prolific songwriter, your job was to write for the artist and give them something to say. And this is such a brilliant question. This is something that I don't know if I've ever been actually addressed quite this way in an interview. It's so wonderful. It's like, you can see me. Like, wow, yeah, you get it. But it was a conundrum for me early on because I was reasonably attractive, but I was never a beauty queen. And it's interesting because I had this kind of down-home Southern girl look. And one record deal came my way. Now, I moved here, and I was writing all these songs. They liked them. I could sing. I could perform. I'm very musically accomplished. I'm good on stage. But I'm an introvert, and I'm very, very clearly a writer. I sing because I write. I never cared whether I was the front person on the stage. I just wanted to convey my own songs. Well, they figured that out pretty quickly. But because I could perform well and because I was cute, they said, well, we should give her a record deal if she can write her own songs. Well, then they started courting me for record deals, and Capitol Records was Liberty Records at the time. And they were just signing Garth Brooks, and they had signed Tanya Tucker. Well, they started coming and courting me, and they wanted to give me a country record deal. And so they took me to lunch, and they came to my shows. But I had this personality that I didn't want that badly enough. I wanted to sit and write constantly. And I was writing all of these songs. I knew how to put on the makeup and do it, but I did not know how to put on all the sequins and things. I was not really, if I were coming into town, I was coming into town at a time where there were some rootsy things going on, like Kathy Mattea and the Judds and Highway 101. And so I guess they thought that I might, the Forrester Sisters, they thought that I might fit kind of into that. But I was very, very articulate in writing, but not as articulate in the interviews and in the, you know, the things you have to do as an artist. And so they figured out that I had more of a personality. They were beginning to make distinctions between the writers and the artists. And the writers were considered to be smarter and introverted, and the artists were supposed to get up there and be the entertainer. And they figured out that I was not going to be as good at that game. So someone sent a message back to my publisher from Liberty, kind of hurt my feelings at the time. They said, we can't sign her because her face is too round. I was like, well, what does that mean? You know, and it was almost like they were making excuses, and they probably kind of were, because you could get an angle in photography that would have made my face be just fine, because there was nothing wrong. I look back at those pictures, but I remember at the time, they couldn't say I was too fat because I was pretty anorexic, and I was not. But so why don't you just say, I don't have the personality that you're looking for in an artist, and you really want me to write for all of your artists? Because after that, they started wanting me to write for all of their artists. And it was because I was so prolific. And yes, they wanted me to write I needed to write through the guy's voice. And then every time a woman would get a record deal, they wanted me to write for the women and give them something to say. So I had to do both, and I had to do all of everything. And the challenge there is that I do write with a very feminine voice. And so I would have to write sometimes with the guys in order to write for the guy groups. But I ended up getting these songs recorded by female artists who didn't know how to write. I'm an avid reader, and I'm very, very introspective. I ended up you know, going back to school and earning college degrees up to the point of earning my, back and got my bachelor's, then I got my master's, then I got my doctorate. So I had a lot to say from a lot of different perspectives. So they would come to me wanting me to help give them a voice. And I would literally sit in the room and interview the artist and say, you know, and find out. And that was the intrigue for me, is finding out, how do I speak with this person's voice? How do I give them the words that I listen to their heart, I listen to their soul, I listen to their life, and I put it through the writing machine that I am, and I come out with something that says it the way they meant to say it. But it can't be Kim's voice, it has to be their voice. And I became a master at that.
Only freedom is my bonding. Only love my prison now. But when I'm on that train to heaven, glory, glory, life will have been what my life is all about.
Songwriter and artist Kim McLean. We'll have the second part of our conversation, in which Kim will talk more about working with secular artists and also with the gospel artists with whom she has been very successful. So successful that Bill Gaither told her she had changed the sound of gospel music. That's next week here on Scenic Roots Talking Writing.